Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. The attacks are becoming eerily familiar thanks to smartphone videos and YouTube. They started to emerge during the last election cycle and included this November 2015 outburst during a public meeting in Spotsylvania County, Virginia, when a local resident voiced his objections to plans for a new mosque in the area.
Nobody wants your evil cult in this county. And I'll tell you what. I will do everything in my power to make sure that does not happen.
We don't want it.
Because you are terrorists. Every one of you are terrorists. I don't care what you say. And I don't care what you think. You can smile at me. You can say whatever you want. But every Muslim is a terrorist.
At the time, several in the audience turned to silence the man to show their disapproval. You might have heard that, but others also applauded his sentiments. You probably heard that as well. What to do when you witness attacks motivated by racial, gender, religious, or homophobic bias? That's what we're talking about today. First, we'll talk about the problem. Joining us by phone is Outreach Director for the Southern Poverty Law Center, Leisha Brooks. Welcome to the show.
Thank you, Ann. Good morning.
The clip we just heard occurred more than a year ago. It's something of a precursor to what we're talking about today. Is that the sort of attack related to what you've seen since the election?
It is. It's important to note, though, that there's been a continuous spike in the number of anti-Muslim, anti-Arab hate crimes and hate incidents, kind of beginning with 9/11 and then continuing. We had another spike after the so-called Ground Zero Mosque was being built in New York, and then after a number of terrorist attacks overseas, in particular in France, and there was another spike. And I think that really kind of speaks to the story, the clip that you just played.
Just how bad is it out there?
Well, thankfully, it's gotten better. But the Southern Poverty Law Center, beginning November 9th, began to solicit reports of bias-related incidents, you know, post-election. So we've gathered over 1,000, in fact, 1,094 bias-related incidents in the month following the election. That would be between November 9 and December 12. It has slowed down tremendously, thank goodness. But it really is a reflection of the rhetoric that began, you know, during the campaign season. So the dehumanizing and vilifying remarks made by then candidate Trump about Muslims, about immigrants in particular, Mexicans. There was some anti-LGBT things. These things just kind of came to a head after he won the election, and folks felt empowered to kind of be able to act out their bias.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking about harassment, racially motivated, gender motivated, all that kind of thing. My guest is Leisha Brooks. She's Outreach Director for the Southern Poverty Law Center. Coming up, we're going to hear from people who are working on strategies for intervening in such issue and when such events occur. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513. Does YouTube and social media exaggerate the problem, Leisha Brooks?
No, I don't think so at all. I mean, we have some pretty hard data that shows that there is, in fact, an increase in the bias-related incidents. You mentioned a number of different kind of biases that have been prominent of late. So we track 315 anti-immigrant, 221 anti-black, 112 anti-Muslim, and 109 LGBT. There were also a number of anti-women or anti-feminist bias-related incidents, which, again, it kind of echoes the rhetoric that reached a fever pitch during the campaign season.
Are there any patterns that you're noticing? What I've sort of noticed, and some of the ones I've seen, I certainly haven't been exposed to as much as you have, is that the attackers, the harasser, usually kind of looks around and says, "Am I alone? Doesn't everybody here agree with me?"
That's correct. So, you know, when you have kind of this rhetoric going on in a campaign and then, you know, the candidate wins, the one who's kind of been spewing this, then people get the impression that, you know, it's no longer politically impolite to kind of air your biases. and in particular, you know, around the anti-Muslim and anti-immigrant thing, because, I don't think it's being exaggerated at all. People are just emboldened in ways that they haven't been before. Now, certainly, these thoughts and ideas have been there, but we kept them at bay. It used to be that it was, you know, it wasn't acceptable for anyone, let alone a public official or someone running for public office, to dehumanize an entire group of people. But now, you know, that that has been proved to be a winning campaign strategy.
What do you make of the behavior of bystanders in these cases?
You know, it's very difficult. Research shows that when there's a crowd of people, and we've seen a number of viral videos, like the Delta Airline thing, the woman at Michael's, I think it was another store, mm-hmm. where there are large crowds of people, and someone is acting out their bias at yelling and screaming at someone, you know, an immigrant or, you know, someone that they believe is a Muslim targeting a particular group of people, it's less likely that people intervene when there's a larger crowd than if it's just a few people, because people think that somebody else is going to say something and then they're just caught off guard. They don't know what to do. But the good news is that when one person says something, the first person takes a stand, then other people will you know, kind of join in. But it was really very, very disturbing to see these videos and see people, kind of a person being harassed in very cruel ways, and just have people just watching and not saying anything.
The example of the woman in the Michaels, in that case, when we don't have sound from that, it was very rambling and lengthy in terms of the video, but her point was that she was being discriminated against by two black women. Have you heard a lot of that sentiment, or is that a pattern, part of a pattern?
You know, I think that it's more of a perceived slight, and so
sure.
Kind of, you know, these things are coming. People, again, it's kind of, people are given permission to kind of talk about their own perceived marginalization. So that has created kind of an extreme sensitivity. So when a person feels like they're slighted, then they can say, "Oh, that's it." And now I can say, "It's you, and I'm the one that's being discriminated against. It's white folks that are being discriminated against by these people of color." And now it's okay for me to stand up and say that.
There is a story in today's paper. I have the Washington Post article in front of me. The headline is "Four Held After Facebook Video Shows Torture of Disabled Man by Group Railing Against Trump and Whites." Have you seen this kind of thing popping up? I'm not sure what page it made in the Washington Post, but it's a shaky video, shows a terrified young man in a gray hooded sweatshirt and dark pants crouching in a corner, his wrists and neck bound with orange bands, his mouth taped.
No, I haven't seen that, but we did in our accounting of the hate incidents got 26 anti-Trump incidents. This is an anti-Trump incident.
Yes, it's an anti-Trump. Yes.
Yeah. So there were 26 out of the over of, you know, 1,000. So that's less than 1%. Those things are happening too, and we're, you know, disturbed about that as well. But the overwhelming number would be kind of pro-Trump incidents.
Is it mostly verbal harassment? Is there a lot of physical? What are we seeing out there?
Yeah, it's verbal and psychological harassment. Mm-hmm. And, you know, there have been some incidents where people have been, you know, had their hijabs pulled off. So that would be considered, you know, considered physical harassment. But yes, mostly verbal harassment, and then kind of graffiti, mm-hmm. you know, a resurgence of swastikas, that kind of thing. The distribution of you know, alt-right or white nationalist flyers. I looked up kind of what was happening in Columbus, in your area, mm-hmm. and at Ohio State University, there were a number of anti-bias, anti-LGBT, anti-woman, a number of flyers that were posted around the university there, and Miami University in Oxford and also the University of Cincinnati. What our reporting showed is that in terms of where these incidents were taking place, they were primarily taking place in colleges and K-12 school settings, which is you know, makes it even more frightening and alarming. Some of the things are happening on the street and in businesses, and that's what we've seen kind of in these viral videos, but we haven't seen kind of much of what's happening in K-12 campuses or college campuses.
What is the Southern Poverty Law Center's take on how institutions, whether it's a university, a school system, or say, you know, a Michaels or a JCPenney, how they should respond?
Well, I think that you know, the Southern Poverty Law Center takes the position that it's incumbent upon all of us to stand against hate and intolerance, right? So first and foremost, as individuals, each of us has a personal responsibility to say that this is not okay, right? This is not who we are. This is not what we're about. And then that extends to our institutions. Through our Teaching Tolerance program, we've offered educators a number of free resources to help them. Teachers are at a loss. Some teachers are saying that they've never seen anything like this and don't know kind of how to address it. It's particularly challenging because they've been working for, you know, the last couple of decades on making great strides in tackling bullying and harassment around a number of issues. And now, because it's in the public square, you know, kids are saying these things, and they may be doing it with the support of their, you know, their parents. So it's more difficult for the teachers to kind of take a position when it may be in direct opposition to their parents. But we're trying to still stress that it's important to create safe and inclusive school communities for everyone. Every person deserves and needs to kind of feel safe wherever they are. So it's really incumbent upon each of us to try to stand up. Now, we do recognize that, you know, there's some danger that could be involved. And so we're telling people to kind of first assess the situation, see if it's safe, if it's safe to say something, and it's safe to intervene. And typically it's usually just saying something that, hey, stop, that's not okay. Or to kind of get the attention of the person that's being harassed and let them know that you're on your side. Go stand near them. Go stand by them. Just be with them. That's typically enough to deter the person that's doing the harassment. And as I say, if there's a lot of people around, you'll find that after one person makes a move, then other people will stand up as well. We cannot allow this kind of thing to become normalized in our society. We cannot begin to kind of treat one another with this kind of this level of disrespect. We can't allow it.
When I'm reading comments online, responding to some of these videos, I see popping up people saying, "Well, hey, they're just expressing their free speech. You know, this is a free speech issue. They're just expressing themselves. They have a right to say this if they want." What is your response to that?
Sure. We're you know, big believers in First Amendment rights, but we're also want to protect people. What we've seen in these incidents of harassment and harassment is that it's harassment. It's dehumanizing. It's psychological warfare. They're not just expressing their thoughts or opinions. These are not kind of debates or intellectual discourse. This is harassment. It has nothing to do with free speech rights.
And are you expecting any spikes, any thing changing, say, around inauguration time? Are there any times that you look forward to or don't look forward to?
Yeah. Sadly, we do think that, you know, as I said earlier, we're happy to see it kind of go down, and it did continue to go down every day after the election. But, yeah, we do... we're on guard to kind of, you know, anticipate the worst around election, around Inauguration Day.
And what do you want people to do as far as reporting? What helps you do your job?
Well, thank you for asking. We have our hashtag Report Hate on the SPLC site. That's SPLCenter.org. And we're inviting people to please submit any incident that they've experienced or observed. We're also scouring police reports and news articles to keep up with it ourselves. We just feel it's very important to document these things so that, one, that we know what we're fighting. If people know kind of what's happening, then people will be more motivated to change. It's pretty frightening out there, and I tell you that not just the increase in people think it's just, you know, anti-Muslim or anti-immigrant, which they feel justified in supporting, but it's also been a tremendous increase in anti-Semitism, and it's frightening.
Well, Leisha Brooks, thanks for joining us today. I appreciate your insights.
Thank you so much. Bye-bye.
That's Leisha Brooks. She's Outreach Director for the Southern Poverty Law Center. We'll continue our conversation about this harassment trend since the election and what to do about it. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. The Southern Poverty Law Center has collected reports of more than 1,000 incidents of hateful harassment since Election Day. A recent example was captured on a video that showed a white woman berating two apparently Hispanic women as they check out at a Louisville, Kentucky JCPenney.
Go back to wherever the f*** you come from, lady. Y'all think you... Hey, tell them to go back where they belong. They can't act like the hero. They come here to live and act like everybody else. Get in the back of the line like everybody else does. And be somebody. And that's the way I look at it. You're a nobodies. Just because you come from another country, it'll make you nobody.
Only the clerk pushed back that day. The other shoppers stood by and watched. And of course, one person video recorded it on their phone and posted it. Some of them might have agreed with the harasser, but others might not have known what to do. The Brooklyn, New York-based anti-harassment group Hollaback has been addressing this issue. Joining us by phone is the deputy director of Hollaback, Debjani Roy. Hi, welcome to the show.
Hi, thank you for having me.
We hear about the bystander effect, you know, that psychological phenomenon in which individuals do not offer help to an obviously suffering victim. Why does this play out when people are being harassed publicly?
They say that the more people there are in a particular situation, the less likely someone is to step up in that particular moment. When we're doing our bystander trainings across the country, we usually ask people to think about what their blocks are. What is it that prevents them from acting in a situation where they have witnessed harassment? And some of the things that come up are fear of being harassed themselves, or embarrassment, or possible humiliation, or people might say that they're just shy and they're afraid to speak up. So there are many reasons why people don't speak up when they see harassment happening.
Does it differ? Is the intensity, does it change? I mean, in that particular case in the JCPenney, I assume you've seen that video by now.
Yes.
She kind of turns around and says, well, doesn't everybody agree with me? I mean, right? And some people nodded, or it looked like some people did, but others, you couldn't tell one way or the other. Does that have an impact?
It absolutely does. It shapes this idea that is the consensus when more than one person is colluding or agreeing with the harasser. I was really surprised to see that once that happened, that no one retaliated. But at the same time, it kind of makes sense because it makes it look like you are the minority in not agreeing with what the harasser is doing in that particular moment. And so there are many tips we have for people to use in those situations once they tap into the blocks that they face, whether it be fear of retaliation or fear of embarrassment or just not being wanting to be the first person to speak up. And we call those the four D's of bystander intervention. And I could go through those right now.
Yeah, please do.
The first D is to directly intervene, and that's just to confront the harasser and tell them to stop and tell them that that's not okay. Of course, we have to be really aware of who we are in a particular situation, because if the harassment is being directed towards, say, an immigrant family, like it was in this case, and you yourself are a person of color and an immigrant, you might not want to use direct intervention, because then that harasser is going to say very similar things to you, and that'll just escalate the situation. So we tell people to just be aware of who they are and see if direct intervention is something that they can use. It's okay for some people. And so use that one with caution. The second D is distract. And that is a really creative way of intervening where you are engaging with the person who's being harassed and not the harasser. You're ignoring the harasser. And you're telling the person, or you're talking to the person who's being harassed and asking them for the time or for directions or for something that's unrelated to the harassment itself. And what that is supposed to do is it's supposed to de-escalate the situation in that particular moment. It's a rupture and an interruption. And there are many ways to do this. And you can pretend to be their friend or talk about the weather or a movie or something completely unrelated. The third D is delegation. And that's where you might want to call a third party in the case that the situation escalates. Say this incident escalated into violence. You might want to immediately contact security. You would hope that the employees behind the counter would do that. You might want to delegate to a person who is standing next to you or around you who clearly disagrees with what's happening in that moment, but who might be in a better position to intervene using one of the other D's. So there's delegation. And of course, if you're at a school or college campus, talk to a guidance counselor, an editor, or a teacher. If you're on mass transit, talk to a transit employee or the bus driver, of course, when they're not driving the bus. And so there are many authority figures you can contact. And then the fourth D is delay, where you, and this is something that all of us can do, and this is something that makes the most difference, and that's checking in with the person after the fact. After I saw that video, I was very curious if anyone checked and asked those two women, are you okay? I saw that happening. I did not agree with what was going on. I couldn't do something in that situation, but I want to check in to make sure that you are okay. And just holding that space for those people or that person and making sure that you're there to support them and create that space for them.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking about what to do if you see someone being harassed in public. My guest is Debjani Roy. She's deputy director of Hollaback. That's an anti-harassment group based in Brooklyn, New York. If you have a question for her, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. This is the second time this program that I've referred to comments on during comment sections from one of the videos. But someone said in one of the comment sections I read, well, you know, you have to be careful. The victim might lash out at you if you go to them and try to console them. And maybe they don't want to be it. You have, you know, that's another thing you have to read in all of this. What are your thoughts about that, Debjani?
Absolutely. I think this is a moment in time where we have to be a little bit more observant of what's going on in a particular situation, keeping our eyes and ears open. Observe the person who's being targeted. Do they look scared? Do they look humiliated? Do they look like they are needing or some support from someone around? And also, by going and asking them if they're okay, it's a very simple effort, and it's very short, and then you can get further indication as to whether or not they need your help or they need your support. If you use the distract method and you ask them for the time, that's not necessarily engaging with the harassment, and that's just really de-escalating the situation and creating some sort of interruption in that awful interaction that's happening at that moment.
We just heard from the Southern Poverty Law Center, which tracks hate crimes and hate harassment. And Here's one anecdotal report they received. This is a quote. I witnessed an apparently inebriated older white man in the park make an obscene gesture at two women in hijabs in a public park. The woman scurried away and the man turned to me, perhaps under the assumption that I shared his enmity. He made remarks about Ohio and to the effect that Muslims are subhuman and that President Trump got his work cut out for him. We exchanged words, but I avoided an altercation and left the scene. We don't have all the details of that, but did this person take the right action? I mean, what are your thoughts when you hear about that? Is it worth it to engage the attacker?
In many cases, it's not necessarily worth it to engage the attacker. It looks like the women in the situation, they left the scene. And the concern is that that harasser will redirect their frustration or whatever, their bigotry or prejudice towards you. And so we want to make sure that a situation doesn't escalate in any manner. But if that person is making the assumption that you're on their side, that is also an opportunity to debunk that myth, to state, I don't agree with you, and keep moving. You know, when we talk about street harassment historically here at Holla Back, we tell people if you're going to respond to the harasser directly, to keep it short, take up space, make eye contact, and keep your message very short and succinct, and tell them exactly what you think, that that's disrespectful, that's not okay, I don't agree with you, and really just keep it moving. You don't want to start a conversation because often harassers think if you're on their side that you want to have some sort of dialogue. And of course, in the case of sexual harassment, they think that you're if you engage with them, that you are actually interested in them. So we do suggest to make your point very clear, very short, and just keep it moving and just don't engage in starting a conversation.
Holla Back began as a grassroots effort to combat street harassment of women, right?
Yes. Well, we work with women, girls, and LGBTQ-identified individuals. And so that is the origin of the organization back in 2005 when we started.
Does the dynamic, is it the same basic dynamic, or does it change much when we get into issues of race and anti-gender kinds of harassment versus sexual harassment?
Absolutely. The dynamics can be very different. In cases where a lot of people who identify as LGBTQ are harassed, there is a much more severe risk of escalation into violence. The harassment exists on a spectrum. It could start with verbal, nonverbal gestures, leering, inappropriate touching, and all, you know, the more physical stuff. But in certain cases, it can very clearly go from verbal harassment, where there is no mistaking it for a compliment, and it can lead to physical assault. Whereas with a lot of heteronorm harassment, there is maybe, can I get your number, or some sort of objectification of your body, and then it can escalate into being followed, and then there is this idea that somehow street harassment or sexual harassment is a compliment, and we, of course, do not agree with that. We do see it as an imbalance in power in public space. But yeah, the dynamics are definitely different depending on who's being targeted. And for me personally, I've had someone sexually harass me, and as soon as I said, that's inappropriate, leave me alone, it turned into a go back to your country, considering the fact that I'm a South Asian American woman. And so it can switch very quickly as well.
Does the amount of time that passes during an occurrence of harassment affect whether strangers will address the attackers? I mean, the longer it goes, the less likely they are to intervene.
I think a lot of harassment happens very quickly and in passing. And so in cases like that, people are not sure what to do because it happens so fast. If something is prolonged, I'm not sure what the data or the research is on that, but I would figure people would have more opportunities to think through how they want to intervene. So when we're doing our bystander trainings, we're telling people that it's about practicing in your mind what you would do in those situations using the 4D so that when it actually happens, it'll be more instinctual.
We have an email from Beth. She says, if you see something, say something and do something. Report the incident to the police, mayor, state representatives. Don't stand back and record. If you don't feel comfortable with that, donate to an organization like the Southern Poverty Law Center, Lambda Legal, the ACLU, or Black Lives Matters. Going to her comment, don't stand back and record, Deb Johnny Roy you know, from where you sit, Deputy Director of Hollaback and Anti-Harassment Group, is the recordings of these incidents, are they valuable?
I do think
I should say of value.
Yes. Yeah, of course. I think recordings are valuable. Of course, it's escalating and no one else is doing anything else. The first thing is the safety of the person being targeted. That's the first concern. And if you are in a position where you can record because someone else is intervening using one of the other methods, if you do record, make sure you don't necessarily put it up without the permission of the person who's been targeted. It is important to give that power back to the person who's been targeted and give them the choice and the options to use that recording or that photograph in the way that they see fit. Because we have seen situations where people have recorded others who have been assaulted or harassed, and they just put it up online, and it actually destroyed that person's life because they didn't give their consent or permission to have that shown. We had one incident where one woman learned about her assault through a recording of her assault going viral. And so that is a breach of privacy. So make sure if you do record that you definitely ask the person who's been targeted or harassed, you know, if they want it and what they want to have done with it.
You hosted a bystander intervention training a few weeks ago in New York, and I was wondering, what are you getting from people at these trainings? What are they asking you about? What are some of the themes that are popping up?
People really just want practical tools. Generally speaking, people have witnessed harassment and they didn't necessarily know what to do, and some actually very naturally used one of the 4Ds without knowing that mm-hmm. it was one of the 4Ds. I've seen more people than I had expected using Distract and actually going up to the person, not engaging with the harasser and pretending they were their long-lost friend or asking about the weather or something unrelated. But people also, yeah, they just generally don't know what to do in situations like that. And so having these 4Ds just lined up in very clear ways, I think is a very helpful tool for a lot of people. So we're also seeing people coming in from all over the country, people who are not traditionally working in social justice areas or who are not would not consider themselves activists. So we've been seeing a lot of people, the average person, citizen, who's interested in finding out how they can do more because they're seeing this happening in their own communities. And that is very heartening to see.
And going back to the email from Beth, she said, report the incident to the police, the mayor, the state representatives. I don't know what the mayor and the state representatives would do, but what are police telling you about, what do you know about what kind of interaction they're having with all of this?
Well, we actually do train transit officers, so the officers who are on the New York City subways in terms of what to do when someone approaches them regarding their experience. But we talk more about sensitivity and cultural sensitivity and how to make a victim feel comfortable, because not everybody feels comfortable reporting to the police, as we know. And there are so many reasons for that. So we do say if you do delegate to the police to actually use Distract and ask the person who's being targeted if they want that intervention, because not everyone who's being targeted might feel comfortable with that kind of intervention because there might be some sort of backlash. So use that one with caution. It's really important to understand what someone in that incident wants for themselves in that incident because it's such a disempowering experience to be harassed. So try to engage with the person who's being harassed more than anything else. And through our app, if you're in New York City, you can actually directly report to your council member. And we're hoping for more opportunities like that where we're trying to elevate this issue amongst local legislators and policymakers so that it could be one of the first issues that they talk about when they're out there.
Deb Johnny Roy, thank you so much for joining us. I appreciate your time today.
Thank you so much. It's been a pleasure.
Deb Johnny Roy is the deputy director of Hollaback. That's an anti-harassment group based in Brooklyn, New York. Coming up, more conversation about harassment, what it means, and what you can do about it when you see it. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. We're talking about the heightened atmosphere of verbal harassment in the U.S. since Election Day. You've probably seen or heard the videos that have gone viral in recent weeks. The Southern Poverty Law Center has gathered reports of more than 1,000 hateful harassment incidents since November 8. We just heard from the deputy director of Hollaback, that's an anti-harassment group, about how to help the victim, how to intervene if possible. We want to delve a little deeper into the emotional experience of witnessing such an event and how that plays out when it comes to intervention. Joining us is Senior Master Trainer, Executive Coach, and Owner of Performance Consulting Services, James White. Welcome back, Jim.
Thank you.
Also, Suzanne Roberts. She's Founder and Principal of Unifying Solutions, a local leadership training consulting firm. She also joins us. Welcome back.
Thank you, Ann.
Jim and Suzanne have continued to host a series of public conversations about race. Their next event is on January 17th. For more information, you can go to the link on our website at WOSU.org/allsides. I mean, the whole idea of just talking about this stuff publicly is such an emotional roller coaster, and that's why you're doing this. It's like if people could just go out and do it, they'd be doing it. But it's hard to do. It's hard to talk about this.
It is challenging, and I think one of the reasons why it's challenging is because most of us kind of think about it based upon an episode that took place, as opposed to really taking the deep dive to understand, you know, what created that episode. And without that base, it is difficult for some to really talk. I love talking about it.
Yeah.
I think it's something that we really need to do. And I think that's why we were able to connect.
Right. Just the a lot of these things. People, of course, don't start video recording them until it's has exploded and is an all-out, harassment, but something led to it. And is there any justification? I mean, people want to know, well, gosh, like the women in the JCPenney's, well, did they cut into line? Mm-hmm. Well, even if they did cut into line,
right.
Suzanne Roberts, I mean, is that called for?
I think the woman from the Southern Poverty Law Center was talking about, standing against hatred. And what are we standing for? Are we standing for humanizing everybody and making it safe and for everybody and valuing each life? And I think that's where we're lost. We've been trained and conditioned. Like if we look at for African Americans in the documentary 13th, in the beginning, they showed the movie Birth of a Nation where African Americans are portrayed as apes or beasts and as threats. And that kind of thought form and image is still in the back of our mind. And people are operating as if that's true and they're not challenging that misconception. Just even the comment that came out about Michelle Obama being an ape in high heels, where it has a long tail of history behind it. And I think Jim and I are interested in holding dignity in life for everybody, and that we have the capacity to humanize everyone. And are we doing that? Are we mobilizing in equal force with the hatred that's mobilizing? Can we counterbalance it by mobilizing for safety and dignity?
You know, Jim, when you hear a lot of the comments on these videos and then sometimes the perpetrators themselves, there's this sense that, well, hey, it's my free speech rights and I've been holding this back long enough. You know, I've been suffering holding this in. That's about time we started saying this stuff out loud.
I think with the recent political campaign, people have been given almost a carte blanche to say whatever they're thinking. If the people who are going to run the country will make those kind of statements, people are saying, well, if they can say it, I can also say it. And for me, it's totally inappropriate for those things to be said. You do have free speech, but when my free speech starts to damage people and attack people personally, then I need to be able to draw the line. And what's driving my urge to say those things? So there's fear, and then with the whole fear, there's a tremendous amount of ignorance. And then people just say, I can get back at you or I can say it. I think that United States, two things have happened. When President Barack Obama got into office, he tore the scab off of race relations in America where we thought everything was okay and found out that there was a really infected wound under that and it was seeping. And I think what has happened with President-elect Donald Trump coming in, he identified what's in that wound. He identified the pus and the things that needs to be cleaned out. So we have a lot of work to do, even though we've made some progress and growth. There's some work that needs to be done now to really, how do we disinfect that wound? Because we haven't, as a society, done it.
You two have been working on this conversation for a couple of years now, since, in particularly since the shootings of young black men mm-hmm. and boys seem to, once again, seem to be all the time, a lot of it due to the video, videos that would see, the video evidence such as it was. And now, you know, the conversation's changing a little bit now because of the election. Suzanne, I mean, how do you change your tack with it?
Well, actually, what our next talk is about is it possible to have racial thriving under current social conditions? So we're looking at how does systemic racism operate in such a way that it limits thriving for a group of people. So we are acknowledging the political environment and how that permission to let hatred get inflamed contributes to lack of thriving for a community of people. And so while we're not just taking a political lens, we're acknowledging it. But like Jim just said, this isn't really new. You know, yeah. I just finished reading the book Warriors Don't Cry, about the woman from the group of nine that went to integrate into Little Rock, Arkansas. And we're only 60 years past that. And yet the mentality hasn't really changed for lots of people, that kind of hatred. And it's just public now in a way that, I mean, Jim and I were talking about it on the way here. Having it exposed more, is that good? Is it not good? And we hope that having it exposed helps more people mobilize to do something different about it, because we can get complacent when it's not exposed. And so it's more honest in a certain way. And my hope is that instead of just inciting fear, I think everybody has to be more aware because the incidents of hatred are more active. But not to get so afraid that we're not mobilizing for change and action.
Robert in Columbus, you're on the air. Welcome to the show, Robert.
Hey, how you doing, ma'am?
Fine, thanks.
About a month ago, I experienced harassment for the first time in my life. I was parked in a strip mall waiting for food from one of the trucks, and this grandmother and her little boy pulled up, and as soon as the little boy saw me, he raised his middle finger. He gave me the middle finger, mm-hmm. and was calling me effing Mexican. And I mean, that was kind of shocking. I couldn't believe it at first.
How did the grandma? How did the lady respond?
The grandmother didn't do anything. The grandma was looking the other way. And, you know, my wife is white. And I told her, look at what the little boy is doing. And my wife started kind of yelling, you know, not yelling, but, you know, she raised her voice and said, hey, you know, don't be doing that. He's an Army vet, you know. And so I got out of my truck, went around, and I was still, you know, I approached the car at a safe distance, and I was telling, excuse me, ma'am, look at what the little boy is doing. And the little boy had his finger raised the whole time that I went around, and then the grandmother looked at him, kind of didn't believe it at first, and she kind of put his finger down, but the little boy kept doing it, but she didn't tell him to stop. She didn't say anything. What she did is she pushed him down into the floorboard of her car, but didn't say anything, didn't apologize. And then my wife didn't get out of the truck, but you could hear her on the background saying, hey, you know, you got to respect, you know, people. He's an Army vet. And it was kind of shocking to see that a little boy would be doing that, and the grandmother didn't.
Yeah, what do you do with a child? Yeah. That's,
you know, those things, to me, this is, it's not a surprise. It's common. This child is a product of his or her environment. People learn this kind of behavior somewhere along the line. I wouldn't say the grandmother did it, but it probably wasn't the first time that that happened. And I think that's what our problem is today. It's the socialization process that we have gone through in the United States that has denied the fact that race relations in America started off in a really, really negative way. And if we go back and just look at that and understand it and start to talk about it, you know, we'll be able to dismantle and unpack some of these feelings. And I just think the little boys, I would love to have more kids like him in my class when I'm talking so I could, they would at least tell me the truth. I could start to say, well, where does that come from? You know, but we don't do enough of creating spaces where people can legitimately express their thoughts and their feelings around race, gender, sexual orientation, and then start to educate them. That's my thought.
Suzanne?
I think what's concerning to me in that is that the adult isn't holding accountability for human respect and human dignity, and that that boy is being trained that it's okay to disrespect. Mm-hmm. And when does do groups of people take accountability and say it's unacceptable to harm or to judge or to hurt or to bias and harass? When is enough coming out and saying no as a collective group, not just individuals, but we need both individuals? And the way JCPenney responded to their incident, I thought they did a strong stand for accountability and wanting to find these young women and see if they need support and saying they're against what happened. And I think we need more and more institutions to come out and say it's unacceptable and to have some kind of accountability around these incidents that make them unacceptable.
Robert, did you have any advice for other people that find themselves in your position now that you've experienced it?
More education. I would like to hear or see more education about any race, really, teaching all of us, you know, everybody, really, about that it's not just the white race that has, you know, done things. You know, we as, you know, an example, Hispanics, Asians, we have fought in other wars as an American. I consider myself an American, you know, even though I was born somewhere else, I became a citizen, and I volunteered to serve in the in the Army. And, it, you know, if people get past beyond the color, you know, instead, because they don't know my life, so to just put me as a general, you know, race, that they don't know anything about. I think more education would be nice.
Right. Yeah.
Well, thank you, Robert, for the call. I appreciate your time today.
All right. Thank you, ma'am.
You bet. So, thoughts about if you're the person being harassed? We've talked a lot about bystanders today, but it's sometimes kind of amazing when I've seen some of these videos that the people who are being harassed aren't just flipping out.
Right.
They're more like, what? What are you doing? Why are you saying that? We just have about a minute left, but I was wondering, you know, James White, if you could talk about that.
Yeah, you know, I when in that situation, I watched it yesterday and day before yesterday, and I said, well, what would I do? And I try to fill up a space when I go into it. I will greet. I will engage. I usually don't give a person an opportunity to say crazy things like that. But I know that other folks don't feel that way. Other people aren't as old as I am and haven't had the experience. But my first thought is you almost want to reach out and smack them. But you know that if you do that, then you are probably going to be the person that takes the brunt of the consequences. So it's a tough one. And I think we need to prepare people and talk about it. You know, we teach our children how to respond in situations, but nothing as direct as that was.
Yeah.
So it's tough.
Well, James White, I want to thank you for joining us today. I appreciate your time.
Thank you. Thank you.
It's James White. He's Senior Master Trainer, Executive Coach, and owner of Performance Consulting Services. And Suzanne Roberts, thanks to you as well.
Thank you.
By the way, they are having another event. They'll have another chat on race relations on Tuesday, January 17th. For more information, check out the link on our website at WOSU.org. Thanks for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.